Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay, we have been discussing the Vayabhairava Sutta. This is Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 4. And don't forget that we stopped in the middle of Majjhima Sutta number 26, not to abandon it, but to come back to it eventually. But Sutta number 26 took us up to the point where the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, has found a suitable place for his striving for meditation, a place that he thinks will be conducive to reaching enlightenment. Then that sutta continues with a paragraph in which the Buddha speaks directly about his attainment of enlightenment. But I backtracked to sutta number 4 because this shows us some of the practices which the Bodhisattva undertook after he had left his two teachers and entered deep into the forest. He had resorted to these deep dwellings in the jungle, and there he had subjected himself to trying to experience intense fear and dread on these what are regarded as especially auspicious nights, the 14th, 15th, and 8th of the fortnight. Then after he conquers fear and dread, then according to the text, he sits down, he arouses his energy, sets up mindfulness, then his body becomes tranquil and untroubled, his mind becomes concentrated and unified, and then he enters successively into the 4 jhanas, or meditative absorptions, which I discussed concisely last week. Later, when we come into the suttas that deal with the training of the disciple, in that context, then I'll give a fuller explanation of the jhanas and the process that leads to their attainment. Okay, so now we're in the sutta number 4. We've completed paragraph 26. Now we come to paragraph 27. At this point now, the Bodhisattva, through mastering the 4 jhanas, has reached a state in which his mind has become very, very powerfully concentrated. And what happens through the attainment of the 4th jhana is that the mind is capable of gaining access to realms of experience which we ordinarily think have been very deeply buried. And also it's capable of arousing certain spiritual powers which would strike an ordinary person as being unimaginable or inconceivable. These powers are called in Pali abhinyas. The word abhinya comes from the prefix abhi, which has the implication of superior, higher, or sometimes direct, with the root nya, which means to know. So abhinya means a higher knowledge, superior knowledge, or also direct knowledge. You might bring them both together. It's a superior type of direct knowledge. And there are numerous abhinyas spoken of in the Buddha scriptures. And the 4th jhana is called the Padaka jhana, which means the basic or basis, the foundation for the development of these abhinyas, these higher knowledges. Normally we think of matter and mind as being quite separate phenomena, and through materialistic way of thinking, we believe that matter conditions and even creates or generates mind. But according to the Buddhist way of looking at things, when one develops the jhanas, to gain mastery over the jhanas, and can gain control, develop these abilities to practice the abhinyas, one could use the mind to control and master matter in ways which are inconceivable in our materialistic ways of thinking. Okay, so now the bodhisattva, by entering into the fourth jhana, has brought the mind to the state of extremely powerful, focused concentration. And now, by way of time, this is the first watch of the night is beginning. I think in the Indian way of thinking, the night is divided into what they call three watches, three yama. I don't know what would be the precise times that correspond to these. It will, no doubt it will vary from season to season. We might just conjecture perhaps the first watch of the night from the time dark sets in, let's say 7 p.m. to maybe 10 p.m. Then the middle watch, maybe 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. Then the third watch, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. Okay, so now we are in the first watch of the night. And so Buddha speaking now, he says, when my concentrated mind, actually I would prefer to read this now, when my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of, here imperfection, I would prefer corruptions. The Pali word is upakilesa, which means minor defilements. Defilements are kilesas. So these are like little defilements of the meditative concentration that come. It's not the grosser defilements like lust, anger, pride, but little imperfections in the meditation, like sometimes too much effort, sometimes too much softness, too much tranquility, sometimes a little agitation. All of those are now removed in the fourth jhana. So now the mind in the fourth jhana is completely rid of all of the five hindrances had been abandoned already in the first jhana. But now all of the little imperfections, even the somewhat coarser factors of the lower jhanas, like the applied and sustained thought of the first jhana, the rapture of the second jhana, even the happiness or pleasure of the third jhana, those have been made to quiet down, those have been stilled and silenced. And now the mind has become, these are the key words, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. The mind is now very malleable, which means it can be shaped in any way that one wants. And it's wieldy, it can be applied to any particular function or task to which one wants to apply it. And so now, somehow, the Bodhisattva knew that it would be important to recollect his previous lives. And so he directed this concentrated mind to the knowledge of the recollection of past lives. Actually, the literal expressed word is past abodes. Pube nivas anusati jnana. This is the knowledge which brings recollection, anusati, of pube, one's past, nivasas, dwelling places or abodes. In other words, knowledge of one's past births, paths, existences. And even though ordinarily we might not remember many of the things we did yesterday or last week, but every action we perform, every experience we undergo leaves some imprint upon the stream of consciousness. And all of these impressions are in some sense stored up, accumulated within the deep underlying strata of the mind. Always they are potentially available to us, but what we normally lack is the key to open up that storage bin of previous memories. And I think for all of us, it's for our well-being that we don't have access to these memories, because the mind in its ordinary condition is not strong enough to deal with them. But now, through mastery of the fourth jhana, the bodhisattva has brought his mind to that state of imperturbability, where it can't be disturbed by anything. And so now he sends the mind back, first going back over the course of this present life, bringing the mind back to even the moment of birth, and further than that, the moment of conception. Then, using the force of this concentration, he sends the mind back past the moment of rebirth, the very moment of conception, until first the memory, the recollection of the immediately preceding existence arises. Then, having recollected his experience in that immediately preceding life, he goes back 2 births, 3 births, 4, 5, then taking in larger units, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 births, 1,000 births. And here the word birth, it doesn't mean just the event of birth, but it means the whole experience of that life. In other words, a whole lifetime. 100,000 births. And then there come many aeons of world contraction, many aeons of world expansion, many aeons of world contraction and expansion. Okay, in the Buddhist picture of the life of the universe, of the cosmos, any particular world system goes through different stages of development, of which there are 2 main stages. One is the stage of contraction, which is the stage in which the world system folds in upon itself or collapses inwardly upon itself till it reaches a stage of complete dissolution, disintegration. And it remains in that condition of disintegration for a long, long time. Then, after a certain time elapses, then it starts to expand again, expanding, expanding, till it reaches a maximum point of expansion. Then somehow that expansion, the momentum of that expansion, comes to a stop and it starts contracting in upon itself again. And this expansion, contraction goes on over and over, just like the breathing, the movement of our lungs as we breathe in and out. For us, it's like we breathe in, we breathe out. It's what, 6 breaths, a certain number of breaths per minute. I don't remember the figure. 5 or 10 seconds to breathe in and out, and it seems like nothing. So the universe also is constantly, or any world system, is in a sense breathing in and out, And in cosmic time, it's just like 5 seconds or 10 seconds. But when we look at it, it seems like there'll be billions of years. And through now, he is recollecting not just one period of world contraction and expansion, but many aeons of contraction and expansion. And in each of these lives, he recollects the particulars, the different aspects of his existence in those lives. He thinks or recognizes, there I was so named, I was of such a clan, I had such an appearance, such was my nutriment, the food that I ate, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such was the term of my life. Then I passed away from there, and I reappeared elsewhere in some other state. And there too I had such a name, belonged to such a clan, had such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared here. And so this is the... And then he says, thus with their aspects and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives or past abodes. And now he says, sort of concluding this phase, this investigation of the previous lives being spread out over the first watch of the night may have taken 3 or 4 hours. And so he says, this was the first true knowledge. The Pali word here is vidya, or Sanskrit vidya, attained by me in the first watch of the night. And I should mention, it's very important to mention, that this knowledge of the recollection of past lives is not itself really the experience of enlightenment, or it's not a supramundane or transcendental knowledge. Because meditators who become very skilled in the jhanas, who don't even have right view, just through the strength and power of their samadhi, are able to gain the recollection of at least some previous lives. Perhaps they won't gain this recollection over many aeons of world expansion and contraction, but even yogis of different meditative traditions can gain this knowledge. But it seems that the mastery over this knowledge becomes important as a stepping stone for the Buddha's full attainment of enlightenment. We'll see as we go on. Okay, so now, okay, he says, this was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. That's avidya is ignorance. Avidya is just the opposite. It's the negation of vidya. And so, true knowledge arises and ignorance is banished. And darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. Okay, now apparently the Bodhisattva is now entering the middle watch of the night. Perhaps it's now about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. And so, again, his mind is still concentrated. Probably my guess, though the text never says this, but after that recollection of so many previous lives, he would again enter into the quiescence of the fourth jhana in order to make the mind still again without any recollecting experiences, without any perceptions, but just keeping the mind very still and concentrated to build up again the penetrative power of the mind. And then once that penetrative power is reestablished, and then the mind becomes again concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it. Now he directs the mind outward to observe the passing away and reappearance of being. This is the knowledge called Chutupapatti. Yeah. I'm using all of these Pali words because at least a number of people in this class are also in the Pali class. So this will help to build up a Pali vocabulary. And these are also fundamental doctrinal terms, so even if one is not studying Pali, but it's useful to get familiar with them. Here, chuti is perishing or dying. Upapata is rebirth, jnana. So this is knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. But it's also called sometimes yutta kam upaga jnana. The knowledge how jnana, how beings upaga go on, arrive yutta kama, in accordance with their karma, in accordance with their actions. And this particular function, this type of knowledge, is exercised by a special faculty of vision, which is called the divine eye, dipachakku. Again. Some of the Indian traditions consider this to be like a third eye located someplace above and between the two physical eyes. But I think the Buddhist texts never speak of it in those terms. But it's a kind of inward faculty of vision which can be exercised through mastery over the fourth jhana, through making the appropriate determination. One is able to see into different realms of existence. And one sees how the mind streams of living beings pass on from their death into taking rebirth in one or another different realm of existence as determined by their volitional actions, their ethically significant volitional actions. In other words, their karma. And so now, using the divine eye, the bodhisattva sees beings passing away and reappearing, taking rebirth, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. And he understands how beings pass on according to their actions thus. These worthy beings, here this is just a kind of honorific expression used in the text. These worthy beings who behave wrongly, who are ill-conducted in body, speech, and mind, who reviled the noble ones, that is, they would have spoken discourteously, abusively to noble persons, to spiritually enlightened persons, who held wrong views, particularly the wrong views which deny the basis for ethics and morality, and who gave expression to wrong views in their actions, who behaved in ways that were in accordance with this wrong view, since they deny any type of moral retribution for action, deny any existence after death, then they lead lives which are governed by worldly aims and purposes, and then they behave unethically just completely disregarding all ethical norms in order to achieve their own advantage, killing, stealing, behaving dissolutely in sexual ways, cheating, lying, slandering virtuous people. These beings, on the breakup of the body after death, have been reborn in a state of deprivation, a bad destination, in perdition, even in hell. Here this is a reference to certain realms within the Buddhist picture of the universe. Well, here this is the picture of the universe that the Buddha is now discovering, I think, for the first time. It's not like he just happened to come onto the scene and accept the Buddhist picture of the universe. But now he is discerning the contours of the universe for the first time in human history in all of its different levels. And so we have five, sometimes six realms of existence I mentioned, but the older texts use five realms divided into two strata. The, what is called here the state of deprivation or the bad destination. This is apaya, is what's translated state of deprivation. And then bad destination is dukkati. Dur means bad. Gati means place that one goes to. So this is a bad destination, includes three realms. The hell realms, of which there are many different hells. And then there is the animal realm that we can see. And then there's something called the sphere of the petas. Petas sometimes translated hungry ghosts. But it doesn't really literally mean that. But these are beings who are existing in a kind of shadowy state, always tormented by strong desires for food and drink, which they can never satisfy. They experience a lot of suffering, though not as intensely as the beings in the hells. And existence in these three unfortunate realms, bad destinations, arises through the maturation of unwholesome karma, through misconduct of body, speech, and mind. And then, continuing the text, these worthy beings who are well conducted in body, speech, and mind, who are not revilers of noble ones, but who had respect and reverence for the noble ones, who held right views and who expressed right views in their actions, in other words, who behaved in ethically upright ways, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared, taken rebirth in a good destination, even in the heavenly world. That of the, this is what's called the sukati. Su is good, and gati, destination. So they have been reborn in the good, a good destination, which means the human world is considered a good realm, and one of the heavenly worlds, of which there are many, again, according to the Buddha's cosmology. An existence, as is well known, in any of these realms, existence is impermanent, not lasting. So in Buddhism, there's no permanent hells, but also no permanent heavens. One takes rebirth into one of these realms, subsists there for a certain period of time until the karma that brought one to rebirth there is exhausted. Then one passes away and takes rebirth elsewhere. And so now the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, is observing this entire samsaric process unfolding before his eyes, seeing how countless living beings are constantly passing away, taking rebirth, passing away, taking rebirth, and investigating into the underlying springs of this process of constant rebirth, he sees that there is a law that governs the process, that it's not arbitrary, not determined by any kind of immutable power like a creator god or some implacable fate or destiny, but he sees that it is the actions of living beings themselves that propel them from one state of existence to another. And in a way, this is how the Buddha revolutionized the very concept of karma. The idea of karma was held in Indian thought before the arising of the Buddha, but the word karma was used by the Brahmins to mean correctly performed ritual action. In other words, for the Brahmins, this is according to the teachings laid down in the Vedas, to achieve a fortunate existence after death, one has to perform the rituals prescribed in the Brahmana texts correctly. And so karma is the rituals. And it is, oh, I was wondering where my best student.
I agreed to party.
Should I go back to the beginning? I've been so disappointed thinking, Shifu's not here. How can I have inspiration to give the class? But then I thought probably he decided not to come, so he told Reverend Anthony.
I was memorizing his Pali investment.
Well. Okay. So... Oh yeah, okay, so for the Brahmins, karma means correctly performed ritual action, and it is the correct performance of the rituals, particularly the sacrifices, that guarantees a continued existence or a heavenly existence after death. And it seems the concept of karma was also used by some of the other schools, like the Jains, but they conceived of karma almost in material terms as some kind of material force that was deposited upon the jiva or the soul through a person's actions. And so there would be karmas of different colors which adhere to the soul, and one has to burn off all karma through ascetic practices or self-mortification to gain liberation. But the Buddha was the one, it seems, for the first time in Indian thought, to give a moral significance to the concept of karma and to situate the base of karma, the spring of karma, in human volition, in willed actions, and to identify the ethical factor, the determining ethical factor of karma, with the intention behind the action. Okay, so now he sees this entire process and he understands how beings pass on according to their actions. And this, he says, this was the second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. Okay, now the text moves into the third great knowledge or true knowledge that the Bodhisattva attained that night. And this will be the knowledge that blossoms in his attainment of enlightenment, his liberation. And here it's presented very concisely, but in some other texts found in the Samyutta Nikaya, we see that at this point, the Bodhisattva starts investigating the chain of conditionality, what this later comes to be known as dependent origination, paticca samuppada, taking, beginning with the problem of old age and death, then trying to trace the conditions out of which the problematic nature of human existence arises, till he comes back to consciousness arising in dependence and conjunction with nama-rupa, with name and form, or mentality, materiality. I didn't want to go into an explanation of this because it requires a certain technical knowledge of the Dhamma, which I'll eventually present as we go through the sutta seminar. But here it's treated, this knowledge is treated very concisely. The Buddha says here, when my mind was thus purified, concentrated, bright, purified, and so on, I directed it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. Here, the key word here is translated, I have to say unsatisfactorily, as taints. Here the Pali expression is asava kaya jnana, knowledge of kaya, destruction of the asavas. Now the word asava, which is rendered taints, comes from the root su, savati, which means to flow. Then a, prefix a, there's some debate whether this means that they flow in or they flow out. So some translators had rendered asapha outflows, others had rendered it influxes, some had rendered influences, others effluence, some pollutants, some fermentations. Venerable Nyanamoli used taints, which I had retained in this edition. But no word really gets all of the connotations of the original. And this word also was a word used by other schools, you say, other religious spiritual schools at the time of the Buddha, even by the Jains, and they understood it as some kind of force which flows into the mind and which corrupts the mind. And so the task for all of these schools was to overcome the asavas, to eliminate the asavas. But according to the Buddha, none of his predecessors on the Indian scene had succeeded, because none of them really knew exactly what the asavas were. It was the Buddha who actually was able to determine what the asavas are. And as the Buddha uses the term asava, it refers to what I would call the three deepest and most fundamental drives that keep the process of samsara in motion. These are not identical with what's called the three poisons or the three unwholesome roots, greed, hatred, and delusion. Because hatred is not an asava. Hatred is an unwholesome root, but it's not one of the factors that binds beings to samsara. But the three asavas, the three taints. First, kamasava. This is the taint of sensual desire, taint of sensuality. then bhavasava is the taint of attachment to individual existence, detachment to continued existence within the samsaric mode of being. And then what underlies both of these is the most fundamental taint is avijasava, which is the taint of ignorance, of not understanding. And so the process of final liberation requires the eradication, the uprooting of these three taints from the mind. And this comes, as the text shows us, through the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. At this point, the Buddha has not yet understood or knew the Four Noble Truths, because the Four Noble Truths had not yet been proclaimed yet. But it seems, this is my conjecture, that it was through the knowledge of the recollection of past lives and the knowledge of the arising and passing away of beings that the Buddha could get a very clear perception of the immensity of suffering in samsara. Having recollected so many previous lives, he would have seen himself maybe as a young man, happy, in love, maybe with a beautiful girl, getting married, raising a family, very happy and secure, maybe wealthy, enjoying his wealth. Then maybe the wife gets sick and dies, the children turn their backs on him, or else he gets sick, terribly sick, and he has to live on in illness. And experiencing this once, it's bad enough, but now experiencing, seeing this happen over and over and over would have created such a strong sense of disenchantment with samsara. And then seeing how, looking out upon the world with the divine eye, and seeing how living beings in pursuit of their enjoyments, their personal status and power, commit unwholesome actions and get thrown down into the lower realms over and over again. Again, this would have created a very strong sense of urgency or agitation in him. Not agitation in the sense that he was mentally just perturbed, but he would have seen the frightful nature of existence in samsara. And then that would have directed the mind towards penetrating into the very deep underlying roots of the whole process. And so beginning from the manifest truth of suffering, then he looks into the origin of suffering. He sees the chain of causation out of which suffering originates. And still he's exploring, exploring, exploring. And then at a certain point, bam, ignorance falls away and the cessation of suffering is realized. In other words, the mind actually penetrates to that unconditioned reality which lies beyond samsara. It penetrates to nibbana or nirvana, the unconditioned. And this confirms for him his recognition that this way, this practice that he has undertaken, is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And he sees how suffering originates from the asavas, from the taints. And so then he directly knows, as it actually is, these are the taints, these three taints. This is the origin of the taints. The origin of the taints, actually there's nothing more fundamental than the taint of ignorance. So all of the taints actually originate from the taint of ignorance. And now, through his personal experience, all the taints have been eradicated. So he knows that this is the cessation of the taints. and he knows that this path, the practice that he has followed, is definitely the way leading to the cessation of the taints. And as he is knowing and seeing into these truths, these four noble truths, in that very process, here we're in paragraph 32, his mind is liberated from the taints. First, the coarsest taint is the taint of sensual desire. This is pulled up and destroyed. Then there comes the taint of clinging to being, to existence. This is pulled up and destroyed. And then the subtlest taint, the taint of ignorance, this is dispelled and destroyed. And with this, the mind is liberated, and when liberated, there comes the knowledge. The mind is liberated. And he directly knows that this beginningless process of rebirth has been brought to an end, that the spiritual life has been fully lived. What had to be done has been done, and that there is no more coming back to any state of being, that he is now fully released from binding wheel of samsara. And so this becomes the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. And this is the classical account of the Buddha's enlightenment, which we find in numerous suttas and also preserved in other texts. Okay, the rest of the sutta, just the other two paragraphs. That just continues the conversation with the Brahmin. You could read that for yourself. Okay, if there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Yes, Suki.
According to this sutta, the enlightenment comes after Buddha, the completing the fourth jhana.
Right.
So, to reach the enlightenment, rest of the four jhanas are not necessary?
You mean the four formless attainments? They are not necessary, and well, for a Buddha's enlightenment, the fourth jhana is necessary, because that will give, that's sort of the portal, the door to the three higher knowledges. But strictly it's said that to reach arahatship, according to the early teachings, even the four jhanas is not necessary. According to some commentaries, it's even possible to gain arhatship through the path of direct insight without relying upon the jhanas. But according to the sutta text, it seems the first jhana could be necessary. But certainly even four jhanas would not be necessary. Only those who wish to gain all three higher knowledges, including the recollection of previous lives, the divine eye, as well as the liberation from the taints, will need the four jhanas. Yeah. Right, yeah.
In that five conditions, the first one is the
sensual. Yeah, yeah.
Which I believe is
Kamachanda, yeah.
Is Kamachanda, how different is it from Kamatana?
Kamatanha. The kamachanda and kamatanha are actually pretty much the same. But now what happens is that in gaining the jhana, one abandons or eliminates the hindrance of sensual desire, but that's a temporary elimination. It doesn't mean that one has eradicated sensuality. But for the purpose of gaining the jhana, one has removed, say, the active manifestation of sensuality in the mind through training the mind and attending to a meditation object, maybe reflecting, doing the reflection on called the 32 parts of the body to see the unattractive nature of the body, and sometimes meditation on death. And this helps to still, to silence, to temporarily suppress sensuality. But the underlying force of sensual desire or sensual craving still remains, but it's with the full maturation of insight and of the higher wisdom that the sensuality gets eradicated at the subtle level, the deep strata within the mind, so that it can never arise again. Yeah. I think these are just alternative terms for darkness will be symbolically representing ignorance. And here the light will be the light of vijja, of knowledge. But I find interesting in this passage, by the way, it's I've seen like debate raged. Well, it doesn't quite rage, but a debate is conducted. How does one render the word bodhi or sambodhi? Should it be enlightenment or awakening? And then there are some people who argue that it should be rendered. Most people have rendered it enlightenment, but some argue it should be rendered awakening. Because the root bodh from which bodhi comes can also mean to awaken. But what I find, looking through all the Pali texts, is that when very, very rarely, almost not at all, maybe just in a few places, finds the image of awakening from sleep used to characterize the Buddha's attainment of bodhi, of enlightenment, of, well, of, okay, I won't translate it, of bodhi or sambodhi. And though the word bodhi or sambodhi has no meaning of light, it's not connected with any word for light, but in terms of imagery, one constantly comes across the image of darkness being dispelled and light arising, but not of awakening from sleep or from a dream. Yeah. Say again. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, though there's no first birth. Yeah, yeah. But he tracked back many, 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 many previous births. Any further questions? Okay, then we will stop and continue next Tuesday. Next Tuesday we take up, by the way, I hope you don't get bored going back and doing more accounts of the Buddha's enlightenment or awakening, whatever. But we do, this is the Mahasatchaka Sutta, Sutta number 36. Of course, this will throw still another spotlight on the build-up to the enlightenment, the awakening. And on your own, you can read the passages I had recommended from